This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about City Farm Slow.
Every single student will try a piece of raw kale, and then they'll want seconds.
Interesting.
I wish I could show their parents.
Also, Thomas Kessler of the San Luis Obispo County History Center joins Dr. Consuelo Mukes on the nonprofit story.
So it's kind of a question of, was it local justice or was it vigilantism? And these events took place right in the heart of our city on what is now Mission Plaza.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 1st, 2022. I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll start with Out of Reach, our series on Santa Barbara's housing crisis. Beth Thornton reports.
The city of Santa Barbara is ground zero for the county's housing challenges, and the city's third district is a good example.
Mr. Gutierrez.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to comment on the fact that we had our first community housing crisis task force. Went over issues like the voucher program, rent stabilization, rent
raise. To Oscar Gutierrez, the Santa Barbara City Council member representing the 3rd District, it's an area changing rapidly due to the housing crisis. Gutierrez was born and raised in Santa Barbara. He grew up on the west side in the neighborhood he now represents.
Growing up, it was a very diverse and eclectic community, where the lower income working class people lived. The same with the east side as well.
But he says now many of the properties rented by working class families are being sold and often used as vacation rentals or second homes. He says his constituents are being priced out of the neighborhood where many families have lived for generations.
According to the recent census, there's been a large amount of Latinos leaving Santa Barbara and moving to other cities, mainly because of the cost of living going up. And you could see that in the neighborhoods now.
Gutierrez says when neighborhoods are disrupted like this, it affects people's lives and causes problems for the workforce.
During the 2017 fires and then the 2018 debris flow, the freeway was cut off. It was shut down for almost 2 weeks. And a large portion of our workforce and even first responders weren't able to get to us because they lived out of town.
He says residents in his district are frustrated, and they let him know.
A lot of them are very upset about the fact that a lot of their friends and family have to leave.
The city council recently created an ad hoc housing crisis committee to explore ways to tackle the problems. Gutierrez says the committee is researching ideas such as better enforcement of vacation rentals, incentives for developers and landlords, voucher programs, and rent control. There are varying opinions on how to move forward, he says, and the topic of rent control, which limits the amount landlords can charge for rent, is hotly debated. One vocal opponent of rent control is UCSB economics professor Peter Rupert. He says there are better options for Santa Barbara, like more rental assistance.
I'm kind of an advocate for some kind of housing vouchers. To me, that's really the only way.
Rupert says rent control leads to, among other things, less building, fewer properties for rent when they're already in short supply, and less incentive for maintenance and upkeep.
I have talked about the perils of rent control many times, which I think hurts the problem, doesn't help the problem.
Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, or CAUSE, is a nonprofit organization that advocates for tenants' rights and rent control. Lucas Zucker is the Policy and Communications Director. He says Oxnard just passed a rent control policy with support from CAUSE, and they're working on a proposal for Santa Barbara, too. Whatever the city decides at a later date will not reverse what's currently happening on the east side and west side of Santa Barbara. Zucker calls it textbook gentrification.
Gentrification is when a community is changing in its kind of socioeconomic makeup, and working class families, often folks of color, are being pushed out of an area, typically by high housing costs, and a more affluent population is moving in.
Being forced to move is hard on low-income families, he says, especially when there are no affordable options nearby. He says moving out of town can result in job loss for people without transportation and cause school disruptions for children. Zucker says in 2019, Santa Barbara passed a Just Cause Eviction Ordinance to provide relocation assistance to residents who do get evicted by no fault of their own, meaning they didn't violate their rental agreement. One example of a no-fault eviction is when a property owner does major renovations.
So a new corporation will come in, buy up a whole building and say, we need to renovate this whole place, and we're going to evict everybody here. And so the city of Santa Barbara recently passed a Just Cause Eviction Protection Ordinance that said, okay, you can do that, but you need to provide 3 months of relocation assistance.
He says the ordinance applies to residents in the city of Santa Barbara only, and that in other parts of the county, just 1 month of relocation assistance is required, which he says makes it tough in this market. Zucker says building more affordable housing and making policy changes is necessary for Santa Barbara County to meet housing needs. But that takes time. He says immediate support is required for those at risk of eviction.
Housing advocates talk about the three P's: production, preservation, and protection. So you've got to produce new affordable housing, you've got to preserve the affordable housing that you already have, and then you've got to protect tenants, because in the meantime, you know, it takes a long time to produce.
Councilmember Gutierrez says the high cost of housing is changing Santa Barbara's demographics, affecting not just people of color and the working class, but also young people. He says it's time for younger, more diverse communities here to get involved.
The younger generations living here, that they need to be more active. They need to be louder and demand more change.
Next on Out of Reach, we'll look at the need for student housing at UCSB and the uncertainty around plans for a new mega dorm. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
Out of Reach is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. KCBX correspondent Tom Wilmer speaks with Kayla Rutland, Executive Director at City Farm SLO.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the City Farm in San Luis Obispo. It's at the end of a dirt road and you have to seek it out. And we're here with Kayla Rutland.
Yeah, I'm the Executive Director here at City Farm SLO. City Farm has been here since 2013, and I've been involved for 5 years. I moved to San Luis Obispo 5 years ago, and I actually found City Farm before I moved here.
Oh,
I was
wow.
looking for ways to be involved in an agricultural volunteer position mm-hmm. when I moved to the area. So I found them and reached out, and as soon as I landed here in SLO, became a volunteer. And then shortly thereafter, maybe a year in, I became involved as a board member. 3 years later, we were finally in a position to hire some full-time staff, so that's when I came on in my role as director.
Backing up in time, before you came here, you were in Connecticut?
Yeah.
You were at the University of Connecticut?
That's where I went to school,
okay.
Yeah. I didn't move here until several years after that, but...
When you were in school in Connecticut, what did you think you were going to do? Were you an ag major?
No, I actually studied nutrition, but I was always kind of more interested in what happened to food before it got to our plates.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived on our school's organic farm, and I was one of the student farmers. My school schedule or my class schedule allowed a lot of flexibility, so I got to take really cool classes like vegetable production, soil science.
Mm-hmm.
So I always had an interest in these topics.
And it must be fascinating to you, the different environmental conditions. Like Connecticut, you would have a much shorter, tighter, but more intensive growing season.
Totally. It was shocking when I moved here. I remember when I first got to SLO, I actually lived in Squire Canyon, which is like a beautiful little part of the county. And we had perennial tomatoes, which blew my mind.
January tomatoes.
Yeah, they would just grow, and we never got frost there, so they just grew year after year, the same plant.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really new to me, and of course, there's different challenges as well, like having to water your garden, which I never really did back east.
You had the summer thunderstorms and
throughout
the year.
Really fertile soils, mm-hmm. which we don't have quite as fertile soils here. So different challenges,
mm-hmm.
but different opportunities as well.
Yeah. So tell us about the SLO farm here in San Luis.
The City Farm SLO, we are on 19 acres of land that's leased from the city of San Luis Obispo. We're a nonprofit urban farm, and so of our 19 acres, approximately 15 acres are subleased out to independent small-scale organic farmers. And so part of what our organization does is enable sustainable crop production by those farmers through affordable land leases.
So without you guys, they might want to do something, but it's a deal breaker to find the ag land that's affordable or available.
Totally. There's a lot of barriers that small-scale farmers face, especially in California. And one of those huge barriers is accessing land. Another barrier is reliable water. So on this parcel of land, which is part of the Calle Joaquin Ag Reserve, we do have access to water, which is really valuable. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that we're able to provide. Something that City Farm SLO as an organization did when we first formed was install a state-of-the-art irrigation system on this parcel of land.
So and you're coming from wells or?
A well is on the property, yeah. And then we do also provide some supportive services to our farmers, and that's an area where, as an organization, we hope to build out those supportive services into the future.
And the services would include tech support and kind of intellectual, philosophical approach?
Yeah. So when I say supportive services, I mean things that help farmers get into market or to address market barriers. Uh-huh. So
give us
things
some,
like technical assistance.
Give us some specific real-time examples of what you might do or have done.
So it can be really challenging for a farmer, for example, to have the inventory to access certain markets. So because we grow on small scale, we might not have enough lettuce, for example, to fill a whole order for a school district. But by pooling all of our inventories of our small farmers together, we could then fill those orders. So as an organization, we seek to pull our farmers' resources together as a collaborative. And so that's a direction we're headed in the future. And that's just one small piece of our organization is the services that we offer to our tenant farmers. The real core function of our organization is in our youth education programs.
So bringing school groups out?
Yeah, we do have partnerships with schools, and then we also have a pretty robust education program that operates outside of schools as well, and that's our youth empowerment program that's offered to teens.
Have you observed any epiphanous, life-changing moments among the kids coming out here?
Every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in our programs where we're able to have students returning session after session for months at a time. For example, in our partnership program with Pacific Beach High School, mm-hmm. those students are with us for at least 10 weeks at a time.
Oh, wow.
And when we have them on day one, they might like really turn their nose up at an eggplant, for example, or kale. But by the end of 10 weeks, when they're really involved in growing and then harvesting and then cooking mm-hmm. what they're growing out here, they're all about it by the end of those 10 weeks.
That's really cool.
Yeah. We've definitely have had students that have been in our elementary programs that have then gone on to our teen programs. And I've seen them be inspired by what they're learning. And they definitely have interest in exploring careers in agriculture.
And do you partner with Cal Poly Ag Department and have the professors come out here?
Yeah, we do. We actually have a really robust internship program, and a lot of students come from Cal Poly who are pursuing degrees in some agriculture-related fields. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're really proud of those connections that we do have with Cal Poly. Our youth empowerment program students go on field trips to Cal Poly, and that's how they get to kind of explore different career options in agriculture as well.
Cool. And back to the kids that come here. What do they do hands-on while they're here?
We have a farm field trip program that's offered to kids who are in kindergarten through sixth grade. They're here for 2 hours at a time with their whole classroom, and they rotate around. So depending on what grade level they're in, they're exploring different topics, but it could be pollination or soil science or parts of a plant, and they're rotating around the farm doing super hands-on activities under those different topics. They might be dissecting a flower or doing scavenger hunts for different pests or beneficial insects and then identifying those insects. And it's really cool how much they're able to apply the concepts that they're learning in the classroom in a super tangible, hands-on way, and then connecting that to how their food grows mm-hmm. and learning about where their food comes from. It's shocking how I used to work occasionally in classrooms teaching nutrition to students, and it was really hard to get kids to eat things like rock kale, for example. But when they're here on the farm and they see it growing, every single student will try a piece of raw kale, and then they'll want seconds.
It's like, interesting.
I wish I could show their parents when they're here, like how they're all saying, yes, please, we want seconds on raw kale. I'm like, really? Okay.
Converts.
Yeah, it's great. Oh, it's great. It. Yeah. And then I think they take that home with them. And then when they're shopping with their parents, they're like, oh, I know what that is. And I've had it and I like it and I'll try it again.
So back to your roots of your mission, your passion. What food is all about for you has to do with healthy eating, organic, good for you. So how do you teach about how to grow healthy food products without having to rely on pesticides, etc.? You talked about beneficial insects.
Yeah, that really gets to our whole farming philosophy. We practice regenerative agriculture here at City Farm SLO. That's an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different practices, but the ultimate goal is to restore or improve the health of our soils over time rather than just sustain the health of the soil or degrade it, as in the case of some forms of agriculture.
Does that include crop rotation and letting the land in a certain area stay fallow for a while?
We seek not to let the land stay fallow, but rather use things like cover crops,
right? So
to keep living roots in the soil.
So nitrogen fixing plants, legumes, and all that.
Yeah, we don't till. We're on a no-till system, so that allows us to capture carbon from the atmosphere and use our farm as a carbon sink and not disturb the microbes and the things living in the soil that are sequestering that carbon. And we use heavy applications of compost, both compost that we make here on the farm.
Compost and, teas?
Yeah, that's a strategy. We usually just dunk our starts in compost that isn't a true tea, but a lot of people make compost teas for sure. So we use heavy compost applications. We integrate animals into our systems.
Oh, how?
We have a small herd of sheep that are rotationally grazed.
Oh, so they're your little crop trimmers.
Totally. Yeah. They eat down our cover crop, and they're on rotating paddocks for 3 to 4 days at a time, so that as they eat down the cover crop, they're fertilizing as they move along. And then we have a mobile chicken tractor that follows the sheep as well. So in addition to providing us with eggs, they also are eating the cover crop. They're fertilizing the soil and, again, just adding into that healthy soil system and promoting a healthy pasture.
Any other animals helping out here?
Outside of those two, we just have the animals of nature that are here. So lots of birds and mammals and insects.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about beneficial insects.
There's a lot of things that we're doing as a part of our regenerative practices to use insects to our advantage rather than totally excluding them like in a conventional system. So we plant a lot of flowers. If you look around the farm, you'll see lots of rows of flowers. And although we're not growing them as a crop that we're harvesting, those bring in pollinators, and then they also bring in insects to balance the population of pest insects that would be eating our crops.
Do you ever bring in ladybugs?
We have tons of ladybugs. We don't buy them like some people do. We advise against that.
Oh, really? Interesting. Why not?
A lot of times if you buy ladybugs, they won't be native to your area, and then they'll just fly away.
Right.
So it's kind of a loss on your investment.
Yeah.
But if you create an environment for them...
How do you attract ladybugs?
With planting different plants that they are attracted to, like creating an environment that...
One example of the type of plant they like or attracted
to. Oh, gosh, we need our farm manager for that. But they do, their larva eats aphids. So if you have a small population of aphids, that's one way to attract them. Of course, then aphids are something you don't want. So everything balances. Yeah.
So is the farm open to the public? Do you have retail operation at all here?
We do sell our produce, but we do that online. Harvestly is how we sell it.
It's what is, one more time?
Harvestly.co. They're awesome.
Spell it.
Harvestly. So harvestly.co.
Okay.
like an online farmer's market. They're a really awesome business. You can basically do all of your shopping like you would at a farmer's market, all Slo County stuff, and then it's delivered to your house for $5. So we love selling on there. Our mission really is providing access to all students. And like we talked about healthy foods and wanting kids to be able to connect with healthy foods, but my goal, and I think really our organization's mission, is to extend that to all students. Mm-hmm. And although we're an agriculturally rich area, so many students have never been to a farm or had the privilege to see where their food comes from or even have access to really good foods, even though it's all grown here. And so we're trying to extend that access to all students, no matter their background or income level or situation.
And how do you make them aware that you exist?
Primarily through schools. Mm-hmm. We have a variety of outreach strategies for our different programs. So social media and connecting with different media outlets.
What school districts do you work with?
Our field trip programs are open to any of the school districts, public and private, in the county. And then we have a closer partnership with San Luis Coastal Unified School District, because that's how we offer our farm class and then our therapeutic horticulture program.
Haven't figured out we're on the flight path of San Luis Obispo. Airport landing keeps you entertained.
Yeah, it's a nice pause to all of our conversations.
Okay, well, if somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
To our website. So that's cityfarmslo.org, cityfarmslo.org. They can sign up for our newsletter there. That's a really good way to stay in the loop about what we're doing. You can also sign up to volunteer there. And then our Instagram is a really good way to just see daily updates about what's going on the farm, and that's at City Farm Slo.
And then you had the .co website for ordering food online. One more time.
Harvestly.co. And my name is Kayla Rutland, and I'm the executive director here at City Farm Slo.
Kayla, thank you so much. What a wonderful morning in paradise.
Yeah, it's a little slice of heaven here.
Yeah,
hidden in plain sight. Yeah. But thanks so much for coming. It was great to talk to you.
You're welcome. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Slo City Farm, hidden away right in the heart of San Luis Obispo.
It's time to meet local author Catherine Finstone, who has published a book of essays exploring both the beauty and the absurdity of life. She speaks with KCBX's Brian Reynolds.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by local author Catherine Finstone to discuss her new book, Those Who Can't Do. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here. You asked me before we went on the air how I got assigned your book or you as an interview guest. And within the volunteer interview group of KCBX, being a former librarian, I guess, I get a lot of the authors. And it's always fun to talk about them and their books, and because I consider books a wonderful icon, necessary element to getting along in society. This is your first book, am I correct?
Yes, it is.
And as we'll learn here, it is an unusual book. It is short, it is small, but it's big, very big in its ideas. I was amazed by some of the things you wrote about in, I guess, what we would call essays, mm-hmm. A group of short essays. Many of the ideas in your book resonate with me personally. For example, your emphasis on using words properly, which I don't think is just about courtesy or decorum. It's about proper communication. And if you don't use words correctly, you're not communicating fully or getting your own message across. Tell us about yourself and sort of who you are and how you got to this point.
Well, you asked me that in an email, and I was thinking about my life as a pie chart in a way, and how I was imagining how many wedges would relate to books and words and ideas, and the majority would. It'd be just a slim margin related to other things. My family is a big part of my life, my parents, who the book is dedicated to, and my brothers. But I would say when I look at my life, apart from their influence, it's been books and observation and thinking deeply about things.
You know, I think it's worth mentioning, and this is part of my library background, also my psychology background, that people learn in different ways, but the typical way they learn is through a story of some sort. In ancient times, those were stories that were verbal around the campfire or some other community gathering spot. And then they started printing them on various media like tablets and ultimately paper and bound in books. But I think when we went to digital information, even to the point where digital seems to be dominant in the scene versus print, it changed everything. The stories were different. In fact, I think I would argue that in the internet there aren't any stories. It's just, you know, gobbets of interesting factoids, but it's not really linked in a linear fashion. So I think when a person reveres books, cherishes reading, and then even writes a book, it's a very spiritual thing, very uplifting and positive. I won't be of any use to our listeners, but that book is full of lovely illustrations by your sister, Jessica, right?
Yes, sister-in-law.
Sister-in-law, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's anyway, it's very charming. Now, the theme of the book, these short essays, I don't know if it's a theme, but it's divided up in groupings of birds. Tell us about that.
Well, I mentioned in the prologue that it has an allusion to a book of collective nouns that I read. And I have the tendency, now I think of myself as a kind, caring, polite person, but my brain does dark things on its own. And I read this book of collective nouns, and then I started, along with friends, creating false collective nouns for birds. And I thought some of them, they're awful, but they're terrifically funny to me. And so when I was I wasn't even configuring the book. I had always wanted to write. I have journals filled with ideas, notes, descriptions, but nothing conclusive. And then a little over a year ago, I started writing more continuously. And I'd always imagined novel short story, but what was coming out was these essays. And then I thought of that organizational tool of the different bird,
like a pride of lions or a gaggle of geese.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the dark one that people know about is Murder of Crows, but the ones that I use are completely made up and they're all fairly dark. And so first I decided, okay, that's going to be the different sections. Mm-hmm. And then once I'd written the majority of it, I thought, this would really work well with illustrations. And so my sister-in-law, who's a wonderful drawer, I called her and I said, would you have any interest in this? And she said yes. And at first I was thinking the drawings would actually describe what the words convey, but they're so dark that I thought that might be detrimental to her mental health to have to draw those things. So then I would take parts of the essays and suggest what bird to use and what they should be doing in the drawings. And
oh,
then she came through. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's birds and then there's birds. But I have to say, I admire crows, but I'm afraid of them because they're very smart birds. And one of the things I do on my morning walks with my dog is crows live in our neighborhood. It's their neighborhood, really, but they'll be cawing, and I'll caw back. Freaks them out. I mean, they don't know what to do. Why don't you are you prepared to read a selection from your book?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I have three short ones, if that's okay.
Please do. We'll maybe read one and then comment on it and take it from there.
All right. So this is the opening paragraph of the fourth essay. And it was hard to choose what to read because I didn't want to give things away. The essays are fairly short, and as I mentioned to you earlier, they build on each other. But here's just one paragraph. The levels of misunderstanding are vast. Let us imagine them as floors in a many-storied building. No, I do not wish to push the button for level 15, irreparable damage to a relationship. And level 2, playful mishearings of words, can be a fun diversion, but where I want those sliding doors to open, allowing me to alight and roam, is level 8, wild inaccuracies eventually leading to overwhelming mirth. Wasn't that Edith Wharton's working title for The Miserable Adventures of Lily Bart? There are many occupied rooms on this floor, but the one I most enjoy frequenting involves my fake parental status and subsequent mind travel of a friendly neighbor. Where to even begin, though? Perhaps with my aversion to parenthood itself. That last sentence is my aversion. As I mentioned, my parents are wonderful. But I had so much fun configuring the concept of the elevator that takes one to different parts of their life, and especially when it involves misconception. And the rest of the essay is about the greatest misconception anyone has ever had about me.
Are you going to tell us? No.
No.
Surprise.
Okay.
Surprise. Yeah. Yeah. I think the idea, the structure of a person's life or even, you know, areas of knowledge, being floors of a building is intriguing. The person who doesn't know what's on what floor should beware pressing any particular button,
mm-hmm.
I would say. Some of your background, tell us a little bit about, you've been a teacher,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've been a teacher for 16 years. And
What level?
High school, mm-hmm. mostly 10th and 11th grade.
Okay, mm-hmm. And the topic, the subject?
English.
Oh, English.
Yes.
And because there is a section, I don't know if you had planned to read from it, but there's a section of you in the classroom in your alternative abode there in the room, which would be a large cardboard appliance box.
Yes.
Is that real?
That's real. And I'm glad that I ended up writing this because there have also been misconceptions about the reason for that. It's just, and this will go with the second reading, I like silly because I don't think there's enough silly in the world and just doing things for the fun of it. And so that was really why there have been lots of weird rumors about it. So I ultimately had to discontinue it. But that's the first essay of the collection.
Whimsy is a very underrated
whimsy,
word.
Whimsy, yes.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author Catherine Finstuen discussing her first book, Those Who Can't Do. Just the title, before we get into the next reading, it's fascinating to me. It reminds me of some of Samuel Beckett's philosophies in his plays or Japanese riddles called koans. Where did that come from, or do you have an idea, those who can't do?
Well, I was thinking about teaching and how many stories I get from teaching, and then the old line, those who can't do teach.
Ah.
And I also like that my sister-in-law, the illustrator, is a teacher as well, and that's why I chose the title.
Huh. So it's pejorative.
Mm-hmm. But I think one can also, then I've had people say, well, you've obviously proven that you can do or can do anything.
Right.
So one can look at it both
ways.
Yeah,
or what do they call that? False pride, but it's sort of like that. No, mm-hmm. I get that, and there's a lot of professions that are demeaned in a certain way. Well, if you can't do this, then there's always that, you
yeah.
know, and so forth. Well, let's have a second reading, please.
Right. Well, I mentioned my love of this silly, and I often am very. I've felt like an old crabby person since childhood, and so when I like things that are just fun, I try to cling on to those and really appreciate it. And one thing I love is Halloween. I like how people are creative with their costumes and just having a good time. So I was going to read a short section from that. My favorite self-styled creation was inspired by the Trader Joe's parking lots in which I've been forced to gingerly maneuver my compact, so small are the spaces, car. How many dings, dents, raised digits, and altercations have resulted from this poor planning, I've often wondered. So one year I donned all black, striped myself vertically with masking tape, and greeted All Hallows' Morn as a Trader Joe's parking space. No, nobody guessed my costume's intention, but once I enlightened them, their comprehension gave way to a more intimate connection. I, too, have suffered such confines in the pursuit of peanut butter-filled pretzels their expressions seem to convey. I sent a photo of myself to a friend in Boston with the attendant message inquiring if she understood what I meant, or was it different in her neighborhood? She responded that she certainly could identify, adding, "This is something that unites us all." As darkness consumed the sun's lingering light, I reflected upon the reaction of one of my colleagues. Upon learning my identity, she eyed me closely. "So, you're tiny and awkward." "Yes," I responded, perhaps too quickly. Somehow I surmised her assessment referred to more than just my outfit.
You know, I love humor, too. I think it's a saving grace. But humor and humility, they might even come from the same word, I think, are both admirable things. And I think it's such a shame that today's humor, much of it, besides being, you know, profane, is outer-directed, not inner-directed. And I remember the comedians of my youth, most of them on television, but of course they probably got their start in nightclubs. But whether you're Jack Benny or Lenny Bruce or anybody else, Jackie Gleason, you, Milton Berle, you would usually poke fun at yourself.
I'm an easy target.
And But if it's done right, it's not only funny, but it's disarming. It's I think humor which sometimes implies criticism or sarcasm, even that's outer directed is threatening, but self-directed humor is not. It's hopefully it's humorous, but it's not threatening, and it's engaging too. Well, let's talk a little bit about your career as a teacher. My heart goes out to young people and to teachers trying to navigate these troubled waters today, social waters, academic issues, and so forth. What did you see over your teaching that is a two-part question, changed, you know, from, say, either what you expected or changed over time with events and trends, and what approaches do you use as a teacher to keep kids engaged and inspired?
I think the feedback I get from students at the end of the year has been valuable throughout the course of my 16 years. The ones who are reluctant to take to me at the beginning often come around and say how much they appreciate me being genuine and real with them and treating them as genuine, real human beings. And that's been definitely a challenge when we went to the distance learning. And then last year was our year back. And I really tried to be aware that I didn't know what these kids had been through. So I was trying to get them to think again, to engage with real people, to have conversations. And at the end of the year, again, it was really nice to hear that so many of them appreciated my ability to get them to talk and open up, and how non-judgmental I was and just receptive to hearing their ideas. And then I like to pose questions to make them think more.
One of the funniest stories I tell, it happened to me, it's a true story. I tend to enjoy recruiting people for speaking like these interviews or in my Rotary Club. Years and years ago up north in my Wairika Rotary Club, I was the program chair, and I wanted to hear from kids. And so a member of our club was the superintendent of schools. And I said, can you give me three high school juniors or seniors that each can speak about 10 minutes to the Rotary Club about what's on their mind? And he said, fine, Brian, what would you like them to talk about? And I said, anything they want. And I thought it's as though I had thrown up on him or something. He was not a happy camper. It turned out great. But it was that little moment of he dropped his guard. What? You want them to speak from the heart and uncensored, unfiltered? Mm-hmm. You know? But I get a kick out of listening to kids. And once you are sure that you're not going to disrespect them or criticize them, they tend to open up. And mm-hmm. It's like when you smile at somebody, it's hard for the other person not to smile back. It's a contagious thing in a good way. Do we have another reading?
Yes. So one thing that I really don't like in life is out-of-season holiday decorations, whether too early or too late. And I see, thumbs down. I wrote an essay that starts with that, but also merges into the idea of how difficult it is for humans to be present. And this is the closing of that essay. While judgmental of the aseasonal, I am clearly no stranger to mind maneuverings myself. Yet, as challenging as staying in the moment can we at least attempt to gain freedom from those thieves of time and savored sensations, achieving, if only temporarily, a sense of peace with the present, a present which shall pass all too soon. Ghost cutouts and cobweb bushes trying to spook the dripping popsicle from my sun-kissed fist saps that distinctive cherry flavor. Bright red and green schematics take me away from the enjoyments and pleasure of the vibrant oranges and yellows of a turning leaf-filled autumn, and pink explosions of tacky love distance me from the vast and varied possibilities of a new year, while reminding me that, in terms of romance, I am lacking. If we refuse to buy Halloween candy until October 1st, if we wait to adorn our businesses and homes with trees and tinsel until after our Thanksgiving turkeys have been digested, if we scoff at the Valentine's hearts that beat prematurely in the wake of Santa's sleigh, might we be able to stop this practice? Might we be able to help ourselves?
Wow. As we wrap up, would you have any advice for, and I'm going to fill in the blanks, a young author, a young teacher, a high school student, from your wisdom and your experience, your unique vantage point, what would you say to them? What's going to get them through the next 5 years or 5 months?
don't try to be what society seems to be telling them to be. That's for in general. In terms of writing, low expectations. I started writing this with, or trying to, thinking, oh, I could write a half hour or an hour a day, and I wasn't doing it. And then I was feeling guilty about it. And a close friend suggested, do 15. And I did. And then it built on each other over time. And then this is what resulted. And I'm so happy that I did it. My love for books has long made me want to be an author. And I just finished writing a second one that I'm revising. And I am so delighted when I can write a good description, use creative language that I know will elicit a response in the reader.
Excellent. Do you have a website?
My book is available on Waterton Books, so Waterton Publishing. And I do not have a website myself, but that is where the book is available.
Okay. Waterton Publishing. Mm-hmm. To find this book, and soon we hope your second one.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I am Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Catherine Finstuen. Those Who Can't Do is her first book. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
And finally, the nonprofit story with Dr. Consuelo Mugs. She's speaking with Thomas Kessler of the San Luis Obispo County History Center as he talks about walking tours, workshops, and fundraising festivities.
Thomas, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Consuelo.
Yeah, and it's great to see you. I guess since the sheltering, we haven't had a chance to see each other, but
absolutely.
You've been really busy during this time.
We have. We never stopped, even during lockdown.
Wow.
We hyped up our social media. We started doing historic tours via Zoom so people could be still enjoying the history of our county from the safety and comfort of their own homes.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, let's break all of that down. Tell us about the center. Give us a little details on the history, how long you've been around, and what do you do in general? And then we'll get into the details.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were founded in 1953. There's a story behind it that we're going to talk about the Dalladay Adobe and the Dalladay family in a minute here. And so they're really the reason we came into existence. But we are, a whole lot more than, well, first of all, the museum is wonderful. Mm-hmm. I know that not everybody is a museum person and history isn't always everybody's thing they think. But there really is something for everybody to enjoy. Even just the building itself is the gorgeous Carnegie Library building right there on the corner of Monterey and Broad, right across the street from the Art Museum and from the Mission, right in the heart of downtown San Luis Obispo. So we do have the museum. We also have down in the basement our research room. We have volunteers who come in on Wednesdays and Fridays. So if you have a question about your house or about your ancestor or that building that you keep noticing has that one little detail or that date printed above the top or really anything about the county's history, we're the place to go. We'd love to help you find answers to all of your questions. We also own and operate the Dalladay Adobe and Gardens.
Mm-hmm. So are you for the whole county? Are you pretty much just San Luis Obispo?
Well, we are the county's historical society.
Okay.
There is no city of San Luis Obispo Historical Society, mm-hmm. so we sort of fill in that role. There are other cities in the county that do have historical societies, Paso, Atascadero, Cambria, several cities that mm-hmm. do have absolutely wonderful historical societies. But we are the overall county's history center.
Okay. So now let's go back to Dalladay Adobe and Gardens.
So Pierre Dalladay was a Frenchman. He came to California during the Gold Rush. And like most of the people who came to California during the Gold Rush, he didn't strike it rich in the Gold Rush. He was heading vaguely south towards maybe Mexico, but when he stopped in San Luis Obispo, he never left.
Oh.
He married Ascension Concepcion Salazar. The two of them had 9 children over the following 18 years.
Wow.
They built their adobe home in 1856 and later added on wood-framed portions after that. Fast forwarding 100 years, so in the 1950s, 1953, the youngest son, Paul Dalladay, was discovered shoplifting food from Sauer's grocery store in the Sauer Adams Adobe, and the owner of the store called a local attorney named Peter Andre and said, "What do I do? It's Paul Dalladay. He's stealing food." And to his amazing credit, Mr. Andre said, "Don't worry about it. I'll cover whatever he takes. Just keep track. I'll write a check," and started looking into it. and discovered that Paul Dalladay was destitute. Mm. He was about to lose the family home to tax foreclosure. He had nothing. He was desperate. Oh. So he got a group of concerned local people together to pay off all of his debts, make sure he always had food in the pantry, make sure he always had a ride to the doctor. And in exchange, he willed the home and the property to this nonprofit that they set up to preserve it. That nonprofit would become the Historical Society and later renamed the History Center of San Luis Obispo County. And so that family, that property is really the reason why we exist.
That's an amazing story. So now does the Dalladay Adobe and Garden have a different location, though, from where the museum is?
It is. It's at the top of Pacific Street. Some people may know Pacific Street kind of dead ends in a cul-de-sac near the creek. Anybody who's up there may have seen the big Amazon office building right there. And it's kind of hard to tell from the street. It can be kind of confusing. Mm. But if you pull into that parking lot and look to the right, there is about an acre of gardens with a gorgeous historic home in the center of it. Yeah.
And so there's opportunities to go and see this beautiful location, right?
Absolutely. So we try to make sure we always have open hours on the weekends, Saturday and Sundays, from the spring through the fall, April through October, noon to four on Saturdays and Sundays, unless we have an event or a rental. And so that's one of the ways that we can afford to maintain this amazing property. The space is available for rent, whether it be for a wedding or a birthday or a memorial, that the space is available and can be used by the public.
So do you have docents that will take people through?
We do. When we're open to the public, we have an amazing weekend manager who knows all of the stories, knows how the eldest daughter, Sen, got engaged to Leon de Sessac, the French explorer, and what happened there. There's some amazing stories. The entire family, the Dalladay children and parents, all lived just very interesting lives.
It sounds like a lot of romance and adventure, too, which is great for history telling.
Absolutely.
We're going to get back to the Dalladay because I know you're going to have some events going on over there. But let's hear more about what the museum is doing. I know you've got a lot of walking tours and other exhibits.
Every quarter, we have our Carnegie Lecture, named after Andrew Carnegie, who provided the funds to build our building, the Carnegie Library. And there's a variety of topics, whether it be racial justice locally or important local buildings or people who served the military here from our county and here in our county at Camp San Luis. And every single one of those, we try to accompany with a walking tour of a significant neighborhood. And so people may have seen the sign for Japantown, right where Higuera and Lower Higuera meet, right where Madonna jumps over the freeway there. When I first moved here and saw that sign, I said, what are you talking about, Japantown? It's Jiffy Lube. There's no Japantown. Well, you go back before World War II, and it was a thriving Japanese community, Japanese-American community that, to everybody's everlasting shame, was torn out by the roots during World War II, during the internment of Japanese Americans. Mm-hmm. It then became a center for African Americans in San Luis Obispo. There is still a Baptist church, a black church on Brook Street right there. And so we have a walking tour of that neighborhood. That was an amazing lecture that also has a great walking tour with it.
Sitting here looking at a beautiful 7-page guide that you have for that walking tour that is just fascinating and filled with all the history. Is it called the Eto Park?
Yeah, Eto Park.
The Eto Park and the Brook Street St. Luke Missionary Baptist Church, what you were talking about. So you can go and download the guide and do your own self-tour.
Yep, we've got some great self-guided walking tours. We also have a couple of YouTube playlists that provide narrated tours of Mission Plaza as well as the Railroad District. On Saturday mornings, we do a tour of Mission Plaza, specifically telling the story of the 1860-something, 70-something, there was some violence that took place between this committee of vigilance. Were they protecting local property and local life, or were they attacking a marginalized group of Californios who had been Mexican when this was Mexico and then the border moved and not the people? So it's kind of a question of, was it
local justice or was it vigilantism? And these events took place right in the heart of our city and on what is now Mission Plaza. You can walk the history.
So, Thomas, this area here really has a lot of history that you have been able to collect within the museum.
Absolutely. One of my favorite sayings is the three blind people and the elephant. The person in the front says elephants are long and twisty, and the second person says, no, elephants are big and flat and broad. And the third person says, well, I don't know what they look like, but they smell awful. You need to have multiple perspectives to see the full story, and that's one of the things that we're actively trying to do better about. We haven't always succeeded. For example, Japantown, so many people don't know about the Japanese community. So many people maybe have heard the name Alui and seen the Alui store, but don't realize the extent to which that was Chinatown. So yeah, there's been a long history of not always paying attention to the full spectrum of our history. We actually discovered, I think is maybe not the right term, became consciously aware of the fact that in our collection, we have three photographs that depict African Americans, despite the fact that there have been and there still are African Americans in this county who have contributed enormously to our culture, our success, and to the story of who we are.
When we look at the reality, it's a lot deeper than that. And then that's the way we can begin to heal some of the problems that we have by looking at our history. So when you're talking about these walking tours, how do people find out about them?
That is all posted on our website, which is historycenterslo.org. We've got a button right on the front to take a walking tour. We've also got various other information, be it about some of the other local organizations, about our exhibits, about the events we host, how to get involved, how to submit questions. Lots of great resources on
our
website.
Very interactive, a really interactive website.
Absolutely.
And I know you have so many walking tours. I saw one the other day about the railroad district. You also have walking tours about Rancho de Pomo, Dana Adobe.
That's why we as an organization exist, is to promote, protect, encourage, support, and share the stories of our county.
You know, I want to ask about your online research. And I think you mentioned that you do have people who could help you with research.
Yeah, we do have a team of absolutely wonderful volunteer researchers who know our collection far better than I do and are able to say, yes, we have cemetery records. Yes, we have naturalization records. Yes, we have county road files, and so you want to know what road connected where. We have maps dating back to when it first occurred to people to make maps of the city. Just some absolutely amazing resources. We're also in the middle of switching over our inventory software to be much more accessible online so that you can see our photograph collection.
That's great.
When I first started, we thought we had about 50,000 objects. And now we think it's more like 180,000 objects.
That's amazing.
Because we went through it, we're working on our inventory, we're constantly working on cataloging and making information accessible. And we have so many photographs that were just sort of listed as photograph, but then it's a box of photographs. And we're working on getting them scanned and described. And now with our new cloud-based inventory software, it'll be accessible to the public to search keyword terms to then find photographs from our county's past.
Do you have a lot of people that are taking advantage of that service?
We had an older version that had a limited quantity of items that were searchable online, and we're right in the middle of transitioning to the more full service. But even the limited one, we would constantly, yes, all the time, get people coming in and saying, this is the photo that I saw online, and I want to know more about it, or I want to know more about that person, or I want to know more about the region. And yeah, it's just an absolutely amazing resource.
You know, it's so fun is when you look at your board of directors and you have a historical picture next to each of the people's name. Nowhere else have I seen that done. When people go to your website and take a look, they get a sense of some of those historic pictures that you have.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that people usually don't know maybe about the history here or that you find kind of really exciting to share with people about this history?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we already touched on is the diversity that
we had. We still have to a certain extent, but it isn't seen, it isn't appreciated. And it's really great to be able to see that more openly shared and more openly talked about. The other thing is how the degree to which we were the Wild West for a lot longer than a lot of other places. We didn't get the railroad until 1895, which is really very late.
Yeah.
So before cars, it would be a multi-day ride to go up to Paso, let alone San Francisco. So there were there was a sense of isolation and frontierism here on the Central Coast that attracted a lot of people to come here specifically for that. And then as the railroad arrived and we transitioned into a more cohesively ingrained part of the larger state and country, having that background morphing into what we are today really still is a part of who we are.
That's amazing. I'll bet a lot of people, I wouldn't think about that, you know, of us being frontier and then thinking about hearing about the grade and connecting different parts of the county together.
Absolutely.
It's almost like it was a foreign place or something here before all of that. So I know you also help people in the community, for instance, if they want to know if they are in a historical location or if they have other issues. And you seem to offer that as just part of what you do, right?
Absolutely. So our research room really is pretty well set up to provide whatever information might be published or might be accessible. Oftentimes people are looking for pictures of houses. And so unfortunately, that isn't in the early days of the camera. It really didn't occur to people to take a picture of their house. It was more a tool to take pictures of people and especially children and almost like having a portrait painted so that you have that tangible memory of a person. Unfortunately, it wasn't really so much photos of houses, but we'll have maps and we'll have a certain amount of building records if they bothered to register with the city or the county to get a license to build a particular building, or if there's a newspaper story about an event that took place in a particular address.
So there's a lot to find. Well, let's tell people how they can get more engaged with the museum now, because you have a couple of really exciting events coming up. Tell us
about
those.
Absolutely. We sure do. So I mentioned the Dalladay Gardens. We offer out for rent private events, but we also put on our own events in the garden. And we have an absolutely phenomenal team of volunteers who, A, grow heirloom vegetables right there in the garden, and then, B, pick those vegetables and turn them into amazing farm-to-fork luncheons right there in the garden. So we've got so on August 13th, Saturday the 13th, we have a celebration of Pierre's French heritage. We call it un après-midi à Paris, an afternoon in Paris.
That sounds so beautiful.
It's the best way to get to Paris without setting foot on an airplane. We have local artists bringing in a pop-up gallery of their artwork, our very own Boulevard Montmartre. We have live music. We have food and wine and a silent auction, all kinds of just amazing things. The closest you're going to get to Paris, right here
sounds
in San Luis Obispo.
Wonderful, especially with the menu, too, with the champagne and a brie board and beautiful salmon and all of this you're going to have. Wow.
Absolutely. That's a truly amazing event. We did it last year. We could not be happier with how it went, and so we're so excited to bring it back. We've got people who loved it so much they can't wait to come back. We also have people who missed it last year and are seizing the opportunity.
Right,
so.
And I think you also have one for the Dalladay women in October. I know I'm going to be looking forward to that. Maybe we'll get you back on before that happens because you're also having mariachi music there, which I absolutely love.
Absolutely.
So, Thomas, thank you so much for this information. Again, tell people how they can find your website.
Yeah, our website is historycenterslo.org.
Please go to their website and see about their events and how you might be able to volunteer and help. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host.
That was Thomas Kessler of the San Luis Obispo County History Center. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.